Good morning. So last time we talked about how we do access control on a typical, focusing on a typical Unix system. So there's sort of the same things apply to pretty much any operating system we'll use. Some of the details will be different. So one big thing we wanted to do is we had these programs that were running and we needed to somehow correlate them to actual users or groups of users, because when we were making our policies about who can do what, our policies are generally not going to be saying LS can access this directory, they're going to be saying I can access this directory. So we need to track, you know, is LS running for me or for you or for someone else? And so our mechanism for doing this is that we're going to have user IDs and group IDs associated with running processes. And we're going to usually set these by having it be that when you have a program that runs another program, it keeps the same IDs. So when you have your login SSHing, you know, that shell, that terminal you're typing commands into, is running with your user ID. Anything you run in it defaults to having your user ID. And then when your process makes a call to say open a file, shut down the machine or something else, we're going to check that user and group ID against a list of who's authorized to do that operation. For files, we're pretty concerned about like making it flexible that we can make choices about who can access files and directories. And we talked specifically about the sort of classic Unix permission scheme, the thing that they've been doing since the 70s, probably, where we associate one user ID, one group ID with a file. And for that user ID, we call the owner, we give read, write, or execute permission. Same for the group ID, and we have a default for someone who doesn't match either the user or group. And we saw that you could set this with chmod. So, and we mentioned that, well, if this isn't good enough, we can have the scheme where we have sort of a general, what's called an access control list, where rather than just having one user and one group, we can have a list of arbitrarily many users and groups and settings for each of them. Now, this sort of handled our normal case of operation. You know, we're writing programs, we need the programs to have the access to the right things, but there's these exceptions where we need programs to have kind of special access. And the big way we dealt with that was having, was two mechanisms. So one is we had this special case for user ID 0. So for our system administrator needs the ability to set up users, to set up programs and access to things that normally we wouldn't give anyone access to. And what Unix has chosen to do is have this special user ID 0, sometimes called root or super user, where the operating system just, when it's checking, are you allowed to do this, says yes. And this enables this design where we can implement things like checking passwords and implementing, say, our SSH server or the login prompt when you physically go up to a machine as just a normal program. That normal program, well, it's mostly normal. It's running as this super user user. And that means it has permission to change user IDs. We wouldn't normally let a program do that. We're fine letting super user do that. And this meant that our sort of password checking and so on isn't actually a core function of the OS. That core part of the OS doesn't know about passwords, doesn't care about passwords. And that means the system administrator can just replace some programs to change how passwords work, to like maybe replace them with like fingerprints or something, without replacing most of the OS. Another thing we needed is that sometimes we want to let users do things that they normally wouldn't be able to do. And Unix has this mechanism called setUserID, where we have this special bit we can configure on programs. And the idea is that the system administrator wants you to be able to do something you normally can't do. Rather than modifying the operating system to allow you to specifically do that, they'll write this program that does that and mark it as setUserID, so it runs as its owner, typically root. And this program can enforce restrictions. So we saw the example of sudo. Sudo lets selected users have access to run things as superuser after typing a password. So sudo is implementing some restrictions that are just code in the program. And the system administrator can modify the configuration of sudo or replace that program to implement different restrictions if they want. And very commonly, we can use this functionality to do things where it's hard to otherwise communicate to the OS what should be allowed. So for example, you know, it's pretty nice for you to be able to detach a USB storage device, but the way that works in most operating systems, the way we detach a USB device is the same way we attach, say, the internal hard drive, and we don't want to allow you to do that. So rather than trying to modify the operating system to understand this distinction, we can just write a program that detaches USB devices and checks that they're USB devices, rather than having the operating system have that logic in it. And it's the core part of the OS. So questions on these things we covered last time? Brief review. Okay, so when I talked about logistics for this course, I mentioned we're gonna have some quizzes. If you look at the schedule, the first quiz releases tonight, and it's due before Tuesday. And the quizzes will be, find my window, via a web interface that we have that is not something you've probably used before. And I'm going to mention how it works. So there's a link to the one for our course. This is not that, because we're not going to call our quiz example quiz. But you'll have questions like this, and you can select answers, and when the box around the question turns green, your answer has been recorded. If the box does not turn green, something is wrong, like your Wi-Fi is off, or something like that. You can also type a comment here. The comment will be saved when you click out of the box in some manner. Click out of the box in some manner, and the box around the question turns green. If it doesn't turn green, it's not saved. Also, you can check whether things are saved by sort of reloading the page. You can go back here, reload, and go back. And everything that's saved should appear. And that means, yes, you can do the quiz in multiple sittings. That is perfectly fine. So we'll have multiple sorts of questions, so on. And whatever answer you have last before the deadline is what we will grade. There's a place to write comments and work. We will eventually have TAs look at that. And this is how we can give partial credit. If you don't have any comments or work, we probably can't give you partial credit. Also, if you think a quiz question is unclear, ambiguous, has a mistake in it, please use the comments to explain how this affected your answer so we can give you credit for that. You might change the key on the question. There might actually be an error in the question. There might not. Especially if you discover this error on like Sunday, I probably can't fix the quiz because I don't want to tell people, hey, nice of you to do the quiz early on Friday, but too bad. You have to go back. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to drop the question or something like that if it's really bad, or do the best we can with whatever errors in the question. And also, like, you know, something between 20 and 68% of the time, depending, you know, the thing you think is a problem with the question maybe isn't quite, you know, as I said, I'm not sure what that percentage is, but a non-0% chance of the time, you know, if you asked us, we sometimes would have to say, we can't really answer that. Because it's something you're supposed to know. In any case, like, so if you think a question has a problem, primary thing is write a comment about it, then we can take that into account when grading. We will try to make the questions not do that, obviously, but sometimes things will happen, or sometimes you will have some interpretation that is very uncommon among our, like, TAs and other students. Yeah?
In terms of showing comments and work for partial credit, so is it best practice, even if it's a conceptual question, to explain why you chose the answer you did?
Question, is it best practice if it's a conceptual question to explain why you chose the answer you did? So we generally won't look at the comments if it's, unless something's wrong with your answer. What I would say is if you felt you needed to make any assumptions, you should definitely write comments about them. So like if you felt there was information that should have been in the question that's not there, that's even for, especially for conceptual questions like that's important. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Just to confirm, you can go into the quiz and put the exit out and then come back like later another day.
Yes, you can go into the quiz, exit out, come back later. Yes, it's whatever is recorded last before the deadline. And your answer should persist until then. So, other questions? Okay, so after the quiz is due, it is graded automatically. We'll have correct answers marked a little more clearly. I have an old version of the quiz system for this demo. But the correct answers we marked, we have these percentages indicating what percentage of people selected each answer, so you can get an idea which questions confused other people. And if you have a comment, we will eventually have graders go to it and tell you something about it, if it deserves partial credit or not. And also, there's space here if you think we misgraded your question to write things down. For reading comments, the quiz will automatically grade it from the stored key after it's due. But obviously, it's going to take us some time to actually read through comments and, you know, handle corner cases that weren't in the original sort of hard-coded key. So, it'll probably be like a week before we actually go through your comments and handle all those things. And that's so, just because you don't have partial credit when the quiz is due at 9:15 doesn't mean you won't have partial credit. Just we have to have someone actually read things. And probably that will end up happening mostly on weekends because TAs are doing it, and I know what TA schedules tend to be like, but that's how that works. So, questions on quiz system? Okay. So then I'll get to our main topic for today, which is going to be about sort of how the operating system kernel and user-based programs communicate with each other. And we talked about one thing you shouldn't be able to do on Portal, which is read other users' files. And there's a bunch of other things you shouldn't be able to do. Like, you shouldn't be able to modify the OS's memory. You shouldn't be able to read other users' programs' data. Like, if I'm editing a text file, your text editor shouldn't be able to access that, or your malicious program will do that. And you shouldn't be able to hang the system. If you log into Portal, if you write an infinite loop, that shouldn't cause Portal to stop working. So we're going to talk about the sort of mechanism, which is both hardware and software, that prevents you from doing these things. And we'll start with reading other people's files, since we alluded to what that mechanism was. I didn't go into much detail. And the idea there is we mentioned that, the operating system is going to check if you have permission to access the file. But there's a bit of trickiness here, is that we want to allow you to read your files from, say, a hard drive, but not read other people's files from a hard drive. So we need some mechanism where it's possible for you to read your files, but not other files. And there are a bunch of ways we can imagine providing this functionality. So one way we could imagine doing it is we could have the OS somehow tell the hardware, this is the parts of the hard drive this program can read, and these are the parts the program can't read. This is generally not something we will do because it requires the hard drive support this weird functionality, you know, of specifying specific parts, and it's complex for the OS to specify that. You know, generally it's not something we can easily figure out in advance. So that's generally not what we'll do. Another idea we could have is that when we load the program, we could check that the program's code only accesses files it's supposed to. So this is nice if you're a hardware designer because it's someone else's problem. You know, this is all software. But this is generally not how our programs are written. We generally can't figure out in advance what are the files my program would access. You know, can't easily verify it only accesses files. Especially this is not a way we write programs. And so usually we're going to kind of use this compromise, you know, this is what we've commented on, is that we're going to have the hardware support this idea that only the OS is allowed to access the hard drive, and only the OS's code can do that. And that code is going to enforce that all the accesses to the hard drive are permitted, and because only the OS's code can access the hard drive, we don't have to worry about code in the program sort of getting around this restriction. So here we're using a combination of hardware and software to enforce our you can only access your files restriction. You know, it's not just the hardware and it's not just the software. It's both of them together. And this choice, you know, is relatively simple for the hardware to implement. It's not free. Like, the hardware has extra functionality to support this. And it's relatively simple for the software to implement. We just need a routine to that the program can call to access the hard drive, and that routine needs to have some checks that look at these permission bits and things like that. So let's talk about what the hardware part of this mechanism is. We need some way of ensuring that only the OS's code accesses the hard drive, and that my code in my program that I wrote doesn't do that because my code might not check if I'm really allowed to access that file. And the main hardware mechanism we're going to have is we're going to have one extra register on our processor saying, are we in what's called kernel mode? You might also see this referred to as privileged mode or supervisor mode. And if we're not in that, we'll say we're in user mode. And the hardware is going to be designed so certain operations are only allowed in kernel mode. So certain operations require this register be set to 1, basically. And this will include, for example, talking to any input-output device. That we won't have allowed programs to do that themselves. We have to switch to kernel mode and be running OS version code to do that. And the operating system, in combination with the hardware, is going to enforce that only code the OS wrote gets to run in kernel mode. So question is, when is this bit set? When are we actually running in kernel mode? And well, we have startup, so the system's going to boot in kernel mode because when we're starting, we definitely need to access to I/O devices. And the operating system will switch to user mode when running any program. And we're going to obviously need a mechanism to switch back to kernel mode. And we can't just allow any program to do that at any time, because that would defeat the point of requiring kernel mode for certain operations. So we're going to have a mechanism to do that. Something I'd like to note, since this is a point of confusion, when I say run program code, I mean all like code for normal programs. This includes programs that are running as root. This is not the same thing as superuser or root. This is a difference between the OS code and program code, regardless of what the program code is allowed by the OS to do. So when we talked about superuser or root, this was a case where permission checks, the OS would just say yes. But the permission checks are still there. That code still uses the same mechanism to actually, you know, access files. It's just that, you know, when my program asks to access a file, the OS sometimes says no. When a program running a superuser does that, the OS doesn't say no. So what's that mechanism we use to actually access files? And that's going to be what we mentioned was a system call. And so what this ends up giving us is that our applications, our normal programs, are kind of written to use this limited hardware interface where we don't have access to certain operations, like talking to input-output devices, in combination with what we call a system call interface, where we can make calls to the operating system, where the operating system's going to run with full access to the hardware. It's going to have this hardware interface with more functionality when it's running, and that's going to be how it's going to implement these system calls. But our typical programs are going to be written to use system calls when we want to talk to things like I/O devices and do some other special operations, because we can't do those directly with our limited hardware interface, the one that you've written assembly programs for. Questions? Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about why kernel mode isn't the same as superuser? So does superuser just like not check at all of the kernel mode set?
Question, does superuser just not check at all of the kernel mode set? No. So when we're running in superuser, we're still going to be up here. The difference is between superuser and not superuser is usually when I make a system call, there's a pretty high chance that if I make a random system call, I'm going to get back error, permission denied. The difference with superuser is the OS doesn't give you that error. But otherwise, how everything works is the same. We still go through the OS to do everything. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned we have this system call interface where we can ask the OS to do things for us. And the question of how that looks. And you could imagine, oh, we'll just make a function call to the OS's code, and that could be the interface. But we can't really structure system calls like that. So let's say here I have my OS code here, and I have the call I'm supposed to use to actually read a file, where I pass the file name and where I want to read it into, and it checks if I can access the file, and then accesses the file for me. If we just let the program call this function directly, well, we don't want to let you call this function, the one that actually accesses the disk and reads the file, because it doesn't have any checks. Right, because the check is around there. So we want some mechanism where my program code can call this function, but not this function. And there's a particular way we've done this, which is going to be pretty simple for the hardware at the moment. And what the hardware has done is it's provided one special instruction to enable this sort of call. So there's a special instruction to make a system call. And it's a similar idea to a call instruction, but we can't just let you specify the function to run in the normal way, because we don't want you to just specify a random address, because maybe you'll specify this random address. And that would be, you know, not something we want to enable. So instead, this instruction will go to a location that the OS specified earlier. So the OS at boot will tell the hardware, here's where a system call should go. And there will be a specific function the OS wrote there, and that's the only place the system call function, system call instruction will go to. So this means that, yes, you can switch to kernel mode at any time you want in your program by running the make system call instruction, but you're always going to that specific routine that the OS wrote and set up at boot. And you can't change where that location is because that requires you to be in kernel mode to edit that information. And so we're going to have some code at this location, which is going to figure out what the program wants to do. So how are we going to figure that out? Well, we're going to have a calling convention. We're going to have a way that the program is supposed to specify what it wants to do, specify the arguments to the system call and what operation to do. And this routine needs to enforce all the restrictions we want. So if the program asks to open a file, it's not allowed to open, it needs to say no. And as we alluded to last time, this is harder to do than it sounds because, you know, we can set up things in lots of weird ways when we're running this code from our program. So kind of our diagram is that we're going to have our program running in user mode without special access to the hardware. It's going to encode its request for what it wants the OS to do, like open a file, shut down the machine, and so on, in registers. Somehow, it's going to run this special system call instruction, and that's going to make the hardware start running in kernel mode, but in a routine called we call a system call handler that the OS set up. And that routine's going to figure out what the program wants to do, and maybe it's going to do it, or maybe it's going to return an error. And this special instruction, you know, is that system call instruction. It switches, does the switching, starts that routine. So questions about this mechanism? Yes?
Is the system call handler part of the operating system? Is it part of the hardware?
Question, is the system call handler part of the operating system? Yes. Is it part of the hardware? No. The mechanism to run it is part of the hardware, but yeah, the handler is something the OS writes, and you'll get a different one if you have a different OS. Yes?
If we just knew in memory where the insecure file reading function was, what's stopping us from calling it?
So the question is, what's stopping you from just calling that insecure file reading function? Well, if you call it with a normal call instruction, that normal call instruction stays in user mode. So you'll run it and it won't be able to do anything because in user mode we have limited access to the hardware. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So we need this system call instruction not only to go to run the OS written code, but to run it in kernel mode where we can do our useful operations. So I'll have one note on terminology. So I mentioned we have this system call instruction. It's called syscall in 64-bit x86. And it's kind of like the function call instruction you're probably familiar with from prior courses. And like with function calls, there's some inconsistency in terminology that you'll see in practice. So sometimes when people talk about a system call, they mean just the event of entering kernel mode and starting that routine. Just like sometimes when I talk about a function call, I just mean starting the function. And sometimes when people talk about a system call, they mean the whole thing until from when we enter kernel mode to when it goes back to us. Just like when I talk about calling a Fibonacci function, sometimes I mean just the call that starts the Fibonacci function. Sometimes I mean the whole thing until it returns after doing all its recursion. I'm sorry that we're not super consistent about this, but that's something I'm just pointing out because it's been a point of confusion here in the past. Especially because the instruction that makes a system call is called syscall. So, and then we're, you know. And, but when we refer to a system call, sometimes we mean just that starting part, and sometimes we mean the whole process until the request is handled. So, since we know kind of how system calls work sort of at a high level, let's look at specifically what this part, the program part of the code, looks like on Linux. So on 64-bit x86, there's a special instruction called syscall that runs OS-specified code, like that handler the OS specified, in kernel mode. So that's the hardware mechanism we're going to use. And Linux has made a choice about how it expects programs to encode the request for system calls. And the choice they made is that before you run the syscall instruction, you place an RAX, a system call number, which is which operation. So examples are like open, read, exit. We'll see some more later. And you place the arguments in RDI, RSI, RDX, R10, R8, and R9 in that order. If you remember the calling convention for normal function calls, you may notice that this is the same as how normal function calls work on 64-bit Linux. So the only kind of change to that is that rather than specifying what operation we do want to do by calling different functions, we specify it by setting RAX in different ways and then running the syscall instruction. So that's kind of our substitute, because syscall is just going to be syscall without any extra information. So we have to say, what are we calling? RAX is kind of substituting for that. And then, because this is a calling convention, we also need to worry about how do we get the return value from that system call? How do we know, like, if we got permission denied or a file was successfully opened? And on Linux, they've decided that that goes in RAX, just like, quote unquote, a normal function call, and that errors are indicated by setting RAX to a negative number. And this very deliberately is almost the same as a normal function call. They've kind of made the minimum changes to handle that we need a different way of specifying which operation to do than the address of a function to run. So questions on this calling convention? So with that, here's an example of a little program that prints hello world using only system calls. You might say, wait, why is the program routine called underscore start? So this is a program meant to be used without the C standard library, because normally we call a function in the C standard library that then makes system calls. Here I'm not doing that. And when you have main, that is actually called by code from the C standard library. So this is meant to be used without that. And I set RAX, our system call number, to 1, which is the number for write. I had to look that up in a table. Like, it's not obvious. It's just there's a table that they've made about what operations are what. I set the first argument to 1, which indicates standard out. The second argument to be a pointer to this string here. And the third argument to be the length of that string. And then I've set up all the information for the OS to look at. I make a syscall. It goes, jumps. This is going to jump into the OS written handler. And that's going to run for a bit. And then it's going to jump back after the syscall instruction and go back to user mode. And then after that, I make a second system call here where I set the system call number to 60, which happens to correspond to exit. I make the first argument be 0, and then make that system call operation, and that's going to go to the OS written code, and because it's exit, it's not going to return back to the server. Questions about this sort of raw use of system calls. Yeah?
Can you explain again what happens in between the two?
What happens in between the two? So when I make this syscall instruction, like a function call, it's going to be jumping to some code elsewhere. In this case, that's code the OS wrote, and it's going to run it in kernel mode. Then when the OS is done, it's going to do something like a return, but a return that switches back to user mode to go back to the instruction right after the syscall. Just like we would return from a function, except we're going to switch to user mode as part of that return. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, would this first system call return something in RIX? Yes. So I have neglected to look at the return value, so I have no idea if the write worked. But if I wanted to know that, I would check RIX. Does that answer your question? Yes.
After the change in RIX to exit, why would you change RDI to 0 to main?
Question, why did I change RDI to 0? So if you know in C, there's when you exit, I guess I should say, when you have main in C, you know you usually declare it as int main. Return x, this x is this 0. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so this is giving the exit status. We'll talk about that later in the semester very explicitly. But yeah, this is the exit code that the program running this program can look up later on. And exit takes that as an argument, the exit system call. And also the exit function, which is not quite the exit system call. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned we have OS written code here. So there's some handler in the OS that's going to kind of look like a normal function handler, except it's probably going to do something where it uses RAX, our system call number, to look up what function to actually run, and we'll have like this big table of valid operations. And if it's not in range of those valid operations, it's presumably going to return an error. And I mentioned, we have system calls, so here are kind of a selected list of Linux system calls. I'm using the name of the C library function that would make the system call. So we use system calls to allocate memory. You can't just assign memory to your program. We'll talk about, why not, a bit later. To create a new process, to run a program in the current process. So it's a little weird why those are separate. That is something we will definitely talk more about later. But processes are something the OS needs to know about. You can't just create one yourself. You need help from the OS to do that. And terminating a process, we also need help from the OS because, if I exit my process, what happens next? Some other process should run. I don't have access to the information to do that. I need to ask the OS for help. That's why I made a syscall to exit. I couldn't just return. Accessing files, like doing socket operations, and there's a whole bunch of others. I think Linux has 400-ish system call numbers allocated these days. But these are examples of the sort of operations that would require system calls. So something you might have noticed. So I guess I should talk about how system calls are handled. So something that I showed here that is kind of an approximation is I kind of implied, we make a system call, the OS handles our system call and returns right away. But the OS doesn't need to do that. So for example, if I make a system call asking to read some input from the keyboard, the OS might not be able to handle that right away because the input's not there yet. So what often will happen is I'll make my special instruction, it will start the system call handler, and that's going to figure out, wait a moment, there's no key press to read right now. Let's wait for a little while, and we're going to do something else in the meanwhile. And that's something the OS can do, and the OS will often decide to do. That, you know, if I don't have any key presses for you, and you ask for one, well, I'm not just going to sit there looking for at the keyboard. I'm going to run something else if I have anything else to run. Also, we saw a different example of a case where the system call is handled in some other way, which was the exit program call. We made a call to exit our program, so that system call handler is never returning. It just goes into the handler, and that handler is going to, you know, get rid of the program and do something else. And this is, you know, all just decisions that the handler is making in its code, right? We didn't call the system call any differently. The OS has these choices it can make when it decides how to handle the system call. It can decide, I'm going to handle this by stopping your program for a while and running other programs. I'm going to handle this by getting rid of your program. So we talked about sort of calling system calls manually. And often when talking about how the Unix API works, you'll hear people tell you that if I write a C program and I call, you know, this open call, that this is a system call. But if you open up the assembly that's generated by your C compiler for calling open like this, you know, this is just, you know, going to be setting RDI and RSI and calling an open function. There's no actual syscall instruction. So you might say, why did people tell you, you know, why do people often say this open function is a system call? Well, it's not really a system call. But often it's a system call wrapper. So there are many of these functions where their only job is to translate your normal function call into a system call. And here's an example of a possible implementation of the open function on Linux, where this is a function you can call as a normal function, and it turns it into a system call. How does it do that? Well, it sets the system call number. And because Linux chose the way system calls are called to put the arguments in the same place as normal functions, everything's set up now. RDI contains the file name. RSI contains that read-only or read-write. That's what the OS handler is going to expect. So we just run syscall. And then we check the return value and turn that into our function's return value as appropriate. It turns out most of these wrapper functions, if there's an error, they'll set the global variable error null and return -1. Otherwise, they'll return whatever the function returns. So this is a library function that exists because there's no way for me to write C code that generates a syscall instruction directly. So our library authors, for our convenience, have written these assembly functions whose only purpose is to set REX and run a syscall instruction, basically. And very often, you'll use functions that are the system call wrappers. And sometimes people will imprecisely say, this is a the open function call is a system call, even though technically that's not the case. So questions about this system call wrapper? Some people look confused, but not seeing questions. Okay. And so our usage of this, you know, is we'll call it like a normal function call, because it can act like a normal function, you know, and then check errors and so on. So you mentioned sort of there are a lot of system calls. We looked at some simple examples. And if you want to explore what system calls your program makes, there's a nice tool on Linux called strace that traces system calls. It's basically a special debugger that outputs all the system calls your program makes. For convenience, it outputs them as if they were C function calls, even though that's not what it's actually looking at. So for example, when I take the Hello World program I showed you earlier, this program, and run it in strace, we see that we first have this system call to start the program. And after that, we see there's a write call and an exit call. And also that I made an error in counting. And you might say, okay, so when I look at a normal program, it's going to be just as simple. And, well, maybe not. So here's doing the same thing for my normal C hello world. And we can see there's a bunch of other stuff going on here. So we have this is memory allocation that's being done before my main program runs. The C library is setting things up. This is configuring thread local storage, which we'll talk maybe about a lot later. It's checking what OS we're on. It's figuring out the name of the current program, allocating more memory, checking a configuration file, checking if we're printing to a terminal or not. So there's a bunch of other stuff that typically goes on, that's like maybe not so obvious in a real program. And part of what's going on here is that to run main, there's actually library code that needs to set up space for printf and putf and things like that. And that's what a lot of these system calls are for, is allocating space for that, checking what type of system we're on, things like that. And if I have a dynamically linked program, we can also see there are system calls for example, load the C library. That's part of the code that runs main, is going to actually load the C library and handle all that. And that's done in these requests to the OS. You can't just open a file directly, so you have to ask the OS to help us. Okay, so that's our introduction to system calls. And yeah, we're not going to test you on all these system calls, but I want you to know, there's actually a lot of system calls your program makes all the time. And a lot of system calls the library makes for your behalf on your behalf. And something I'd say, overall, is that the way we write applications is that we write applications against our normal hardware interface, our add, subtract, push, call, return, our normal hardware interface, plus a library interface. And that library interface, has things like printf, open, etc. And that's implemented using this system call interface to access sort of special functionality. Questions on system calls, since we're going to move on to talk about going beyond system calls, other things that this kernel part of the OS, this core part of the OS does, other hardware support. Okay, so let's go back to some other things you're not supposed to be able to do on a shared system like Portal. So one thing you shouldn't be able to do is you shouldn't be able to have your program accidentally or on purpose modify the OS's memory or access other users' data in memory. And you probably intuitively know that's not possible. So let's do see what how you think programs work or should work. So let's say I have these two programs running on the same system. And in program A, I have a variable, a global variable at address 10000, that's set to 42. And I'm going to load that value into REX sometime later. And in program B, I set REX to 99 and store that to address 10000. What do we expect if we run these two programs at the same time? What should REX be in A, in program A? So you have these two programs running at the same time, and they're both accessing something at address 10000. Okay, who likes some more time? So who thinks it should be A, B, C, D, E, F, no clue. Okay, we have a real spread of answers. So first, on answer C, in AT&T syntax assembly, this is memory at x1234. If we want the constant value of that, we need to do a dollar sign. So just a reminder about, or maybe for the first time if you didn't take CS01, because I think we covered that in CS01, how that works. This is not how Intel syntax assembly works, which is one reason this is confusing. So C is not possible because of that reason, so just reviewing what this assembly is. But then we have a real split between all the other answers. And I will tell you that on all the types of OSs you have used, most likely the answer is 42. There are OSs where the answer is not that, but in any normal OS designed to support multiple users that you've used, the answer is going to be 42 always. That it doesn't matter what program B is doing, program B is not just going to be able to magically write to program A's memory, even if it uses the same address. And in program B, what's going to happen is one of two things is either this access is going to fail and going to crash, probably with something that might display to a user something like a segmentation fault, or program B is going to have its own independent data at that address. Those are kind of our two possibilities. So it is true that program B might crash, but in the OSs you've used, you know, program A not going to be affected by the crazy stuff program B is doing, unless it deliberately sets up a situation to do that. So program B might crash. Or maybe program B will have its own memory at that location. So we'll talk much more about how address translation, which we mentioned at the beginning of the semester, works. But basically, when program A is running, it has its own idea of what's in memory, that because we have our program addresses go through this mapping that the OS sets to real addresses. And this mapping is changed when we're running program A versus program B. And so that means program A and program B can have completely different ideas about what is at address 10,000. And also, address 10,000 might not have an entry in the mapping for program B's at address 10,000, in which case it will crash. So questions on my answer about what happens in this case on a typical modern OS, typical multi-user OS, I should say. So this would be less true in like the OS for like a, you know, embedded device, like maybe wouldn't have this feature, but OSs for running multiple users programs are generally going to support, make this behavior happen all the time. So we talked about a program crashing, and a program crashing is an interesting thing to think about. How does that actually work? What's actually happening if this operation here, if this is a, if this is a seg fault, what is that actually doing in the hardware? You know, if we think of what typically happens when you do that on a system like Linux, some other program is informed of this and displays a message, like segmentation fault, and some other program gets to run on the processor. So how does that happen? Like, there's obviously no code here that says, please write the message segmentation fault. There's no code here which says, please switch to another program. There's no system call. Remember, system call was a special instruction. That's not that special instruction. It's a normal move instruction. So we're going to need some help from the hardware to actually be able to crash our program in this case. And the hardware is not going to know, like, how to inform some program to print segmentation fault, like, especially because, like, that's different. Like, if I'm SSHing in or in person, that would be really complicated to have the hardware do that itself. The hardware is not going to know about how to run a different program because it doesn't know how all the details of the OS work to handle, figure out what programs are active and which ones should run now. So what the hardware is going to do is when the program does this operation that it's not supposed to do of accessing memory that doesn't make sense, it's going to run some designated OS routine. And this sounds very much like a system call, right? In a system call, when a program asked for it, we ran some designated OS routine. Here, the hardware is asking us to run a designated routine because it doesn't know what to do with this move instruction. So we're going to have this generalization of system calls to something we'll call hardware exceptions. I'll just write exceptions. Sometimes I might say hardware exceptions because I don't mean the Java exceptions. I mean, this is a different thing. So in system calls, the software asks the OS for help. We also have cases where the hardware is asking the OS for help. And we'll call this general idea exceptions, of that we're going to ask the OS for some help, run a routine in the OS to handle a situation. That routine's going to run in kernel mode and be able to do whatever the OS wants to do about this situation. And the mechanism is going to look very much like system calls, that whenever one of these events that needs the OS's help happens, we're going to switch to kernel mode, if we aren't there already, and call a function the OS set up at boot. So it's the same mechanism, just different trigger. And so right now, we know about kind of two categories of these exceptions. We have our system calls, where the program deliberately asks the OS for help. And we have these exceptions, which are triggered by errors in programs or other weird events in programs, where basically the hardware says, I don't know what to do here. Please help me. And this includes accessing memory that isn't valid. It includes trying to run a privileged instruction. So if you try to set the system call handler to a different location in user mode, well, you aren't allowed to do that, but what does the hardware do about that? Well, typically it asks the OS, hey, this program is trying to change these settings. It's not allowed to change. What do you want to do? Or like if you try to divide by zero, typically the hardware will ask the OS, hey, what do you want to do about this program that divided by zero? Yeah? Question, are exceptions only when the hardware asks the operating system? So exceptions encompass all of these cases. Exceptions are about, we have this mechanism here where we're going to switch to an OS handler. So any case where we have some hardware assisted switch to the OS handler in kernel mode. Does that answer your question?
So it's different.
Question, it's different from system calls? So system calls are a kind of exception. I have my picture. So what we call like seg faults and system calls are both kinds of exception. So the exception idea is this is the hardware running an OS handler to do something, but the reason is different. So for system calls, the reason is the program that we were running asked for it. For things like faults, like seg faults, it's the program did something weird and we need to ask the OS how to handle that. Does that answer your question? Okay, and so far I kind of had these two categories, and as this slide mentions, we're going to have actually some other category that's going to trigger the same exception mechanism. We're also going to want to run something in the OS to handle a situation. And this is to deal with, what about hanging the system? So one thing I shouldn't be able to do on portal is that if I write, you know, my favorite program, you know, this program, and run it on portal, and maybe run 100 copies of it on portal, you should still be able to use portal, like you'd hope. But if I think about what this code is going to look like, well, there's nothing in the code here that stops it from hiding the processor. So something needs to stop that from happening. And if we look at what I've listed so far here, well, there's no system calls in there because I'm not requesting to do anything in that program that asks for help from the OS. Like, I can do a loop perfectly fine without the OS's help. And there's no errors. I'm not, like, accessing invalid memory. I'm not doing any bad instructions. So there needs to be something else which can trigger the OS to run. And that's going to use the same mechanism, but it's not going to be triggered by a system call or by something the program did. It's going to be triggered by some sort of external event. And we're going to basically have multiple types of external events that might do this. So most notably, precisely to prevent my infinite loop from hiding the CPU, the operating system is typically going to set up a timer in the hardware to go off. And when that goes off, we're going to use the same mechanism to run an OS handler, not to handle the program doing something weird, but to handle a timer expired. Alternately, maybe I type some things in, or there's some input from the network. And that event is something the OS needs to handle, even if that input is for something that's not currently running. So that will be an event that triggers the OS to run because the hardware needs to ask, hey OS, the hard drive has this data for you, or you got this data from the network, what should you do about it? And so the OS will get to run even in the middle of a program that's completely unrelated to the input, because that input needs to be handled. And I also mentioned output because, like, you know, maybe the network devices saying, hey, I sent that thing you asked me to send earlier. Do you have more memory to send? You know, the OS needs to handle that, and it needs to handle that even if the program we're currently running has nothing to do with that device, because the program that actually does, you know, isn't active just at the moment. So these are all types of exceptions, as I mentioned, just with different causes. So we have our deliberately triggered exceptions, the ones that the program triggered. We have the ones that the program triggered but unintentionally, like segfaults. And we have the runs that are triggered externally, like input and output or timers. And I'm using the terms interrupts and faults. That's the terms we use in the reading. I'm going to not use these terms very much because they're not super consistent, as I'll mention later, but you know, we can kind of separate them out into these categories based on their causes. But whatever the cause of these exceptions, the key thing that makes them all be considered these exceptions, the one thing, is that they all have the same pattern. That we're going to be running something, usually in user mode, and an exception is triggered. Either it's triggered by the code we were running, or maybe it's triggered by something completely external, like I pressed a key. That's going to start in kernel mode, the handler for that exception, and that's going to be OS code that decides what to do. And what does it do? Whatever the OS author decided to do in that case. And eventually, that handler will exit. And when it exits, it's not obliged to exit to the same program. So for example, if this was triggered by a segfault or an exit system call, probably when this handler exits, we aren't running the same program. If it was triggered by like a simple print, probably we are. But that's kind of contextual. It depends on what decision the OS made about what should run next. So questions about this exception process? So this exception mechanism, with all the different causes of exceptions, allows us to implement kind of one of the most important things operating systems do, which is what we can call time multiplexing, which is sharing our processor over time. So even if I have a single core, I can run lots of programs on that core, but we know the way the processor actually works. We can't actually have multiple programs actually running at the same time. So what happens is we're going to run one program, and then there's going to be an exception. So if this program's our infinite loop, probably that's something like a timer. If it's a program that like reads input or something like that, probably not. And the OS can deliberately switch to a different program as a result of that exception. And in this way, it can make sure that the processor is shared between multiple programs, and it can do this in small enough time slices that it kind of looks like all the programs are running at the same time, even though physically that's not the case. Some questions? Time multiplexing, yes?
So if I like accidentally make it,
so if you make an infinite loop and you type control C to end the program, is that an exception? So generally input triggers an exception so the OS can handle that. So yeah, so the control C is indirectly causing an exception because the OS needs to handle that input. Yeah, and the handler for that might be deciding to act on your program, maybe. Does that answer your question? And I guess the other thing I'd say is if you have an infinite loop, I mentioned we have these timers. Typically, those are set for like 1 to 10 milliseconds. So there's probably timers going off probably before you can press Control C. Other questions? So we have this thing where during handling an exception, we can choose to have the OS return to a different program. This is known as a context switch. And how does this work? Well, we're going to save the state of the program that was running in case we want to just go back to it later. So if we think of this case here, when we switch away from loop, we better save state of loop somewhere so we can restore it later. Otherwise, this won't work. Otherwise, we can't go back to that program. And we're going to restore the state of some other program we had some from earlier. So this idea is called a context switch. And this information we're saving, so we're saving the registers, where the program counter, and that the address mapping, so what memory is valid, that's called the context. So when we have one of these exceptions cause the OS to say, I should run a different program now, basically what's happening is program A was running, and the OS, while program A was running, had the state for program B stashed in its memory somewhere. And when it decides to switch from program A to program B, an exception handler will run, and that handler is going to copy the state from process A back into the OS's memory. Should probably have this in the other way. Right. So this is going to point to there and copy the state for process B back into the processor's registers. Questions? Context switch idea. So this gives us what we're going to call a thread. That if I think of what process A and process B are seeing here, is that it kind of looks like each of them has their own register values, and each of them has their own program counter. But what's actually happening is that they're sharing one processor. And we call this illusion that you have your own processor, even though you might be sharing it with lots of other programs, a thread. So you have it looks like you have all the things a processor has, registers, condition codes, program counters, you know. But it's actually shared with other programs. And our implementation is that we swap out whose registers and program counters are active on the processor periodically. And our mechanism for doing this is that the OS gets to run and, well, it just sets registers and saves registers somewhere else. Now, so typically the OS's memory is where they're going to be stored when they're not active on the processor. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk a bit more about how exceptions work with I/O devices. Since this is a point of confusion, people I say there's exceptions with I/O devices, we'll talk about exactly when there is and what they're for.